As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for joining us on The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. It's Mark Carey here. You'll notice this is not the voice of Ali Maxwell, but do not fear. I'm very much just alone signing in the big chair. No option to buy. Ali's going to be back with us very, very soon. Now, you might have noticed there's a World Cup going on. The first round of fixtures are complete and true to Tactics Pod form. We're going to be opening up a World Cup notebook to reflect upon some themes, some observations, and some standout moments. And to help me with that, we've got none other than the stalwart member of the Tactics Pod. It's Michael Cox, who is out in Qatar as we speak. Michael, how are you enjoying your new surroundings?
Yeah, it's been good. I mean, it's been very frantic trying to rush off to multiple games in one day, but it's a unique World Cup in the sense that you can do that. So, yeah, it's been good. I've only been here two full days, but I've seen two games in each of those days. And yeah, I haven't seen any of the real stinking nil-nils so far, so I'm doing okay.
We'll be covering it all very shortly. Joining Michael is one of the busiest men I know. It's Ahmed Waleed. He's back on the pod. Ahmed, welcome back.
Hey, Mark. I've seen some of the stinking nil-nils that Michael have missed. Yeah, there were some enjoyable games, like some huge upsets and close upsets. But yeah, enjoying a bit. Other games are too slow. But yeah, four games a day, definitely too much.
Michael, you said obviously you've been to some of the games already. I wanted to know what the atmosphere has been like in the games that you have attended. Obviously, watching it through the television is a wholly different experience. What's the atmosphere been like?
Pretty mixed, I would say. I've been to a couple of games where there's been a noticeable amount of empty seats, particularly the Switzerland game yesterday, I think, was probably the best example of that. Switzerland against Cameroon, which was in a kind of out-of-town stadium in the south, so I don't think attracted many kind of neutral fans who are here for other teams, and neither Switzerland nor Cameroon have brought a particularly high number of people. But on the positive side of things, I was at the Canada game yesterday when they were, the day before yesterday when they were pretty unlucky, I thought, to lose to Belgium, and their support was fantastic. And actually, my plane over from London, I think, was about 50% Canadians, which was great to see. And the Japanese support as well. I know there's been lots of coverage of them sweeping up after themselves, as usual, after the full-time whistle. But during the game itself, they've got a lot of fans here. And obviously, they really enjoyed that victory over Germany.
Indeed. Yeah, we'll definitely come on to that. So yeah, as I mentioned, I think it's safe to say that we're not going to go through every single game played so far, because we'd, of course, be here all day. So instead, we're going to slice up our chat thematically. We're going to start, I think it's a good place to start, is with the formality victories, shall we say, among some of the favourites of the tournament. We'll start with England, comprehensive 6-2 winners against Iran, which is no mean feat, really, in the context of some of Iran's performances in qualifying and in the context of some of the other results. Michael, you noted England's fullbacks as key to their success on the day.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because they were playing against a side that was playing kind of 5-3-2, sometimes 5-4-1. And I thought there was a marked contrast to the way that England played against Scotland in the Euros last year, where they were playing against a similar system. And clearly the two fullbacks on that day had been told just don't advance, don't overlap, don't push forward into the final third. And of course that was a game where England basically were happy with the point. But this game, I thought the fullbacks were really key to the way England played. I think Trippier has always done well for England, you know, contributed a really important goal in the semi-final of the World Cup 4 years ago, created the opener for Luke Shaw in the Euros final. And I think coming into this tournament, he's probably the most informed England player. He's been so good for Newcastle. And I think England, they really dominated in the early stages by going down the right. I think some of the rotations down that flank were quite useful. Sometimes it was Trippier coming inside and Saka kind of dropping deep to receive, which isn't the type of thing we've really seen too much from England before. And of course, the slight outlier was the fact that the opening goal came from across from Shaw from the left. And I think he had a pretty good game as well. I think if you pick a man of the match, I'd be in the Jude Bellingham camp. I think like most people, I think he was absolutely sensational. But tactically, I thought the fullbacks were really vital throughout the game. And it's been one of the main areas of debate about who should play right back. I think at the start of this year, maybe Trippier would have been fourth choice for that spot behind Walker and James and Alexander Arnold. But I think he's deservedly in the team and, yeah, played very well.
And it looks from what we're seeing that Southgate's going to go with the same team, an unchanged side against the United States men's team later today. So other comprehensive winners within this category, France had a bit of an early scare but were comfortable 4-1 winners in the end against Australia. Spain comfortably beating Costa Rica 7-0, record-breaking 82% share of possession there. Brazil last night, 2-0 win, but it wasn't quite a thrashing, but I don't think Serbia had a shot on target across the full game. I was going to say 90 minutes, but I can't say that, and we'll come on to why. Ahmed, can we take anything tactically from these, I'm going to call them early thrashings, or do we just put it down to just a golfing quality in the first round of games?
I think for Brazil, it was a golfing quality. Like, I expected more from Brazil. In the first half, I felt that, like, Serbia's off-ball organization limited Brazil. Like, they had a close shot from Rafinha, but that was it in the first half. Like, some shots from outside of the box. In the second half, like, their quality dominated. Like, Neymar, Vini on the left. I thought Casemiro had a great game. But yeah, if we came on to France and Spain, I know, like, 7-0 sounds like men against boys. But yeah, I was really impressed with Spain's possession game. Of course, the rotations from the front three, Asensio dropping. I know Luis Enrique went on stream and said it's not a false nine, but this is just a linguistic problem. It's what he does in terms of dropping and linking, with Olmo going and being behind, as we've seen in the first goal. And we've also got Gavi and Pedri. I think they are great. So before Spain had Koki, I think on the right, I think Gavi offers a better solution going forward in terms of runs of the ball, in terms of his intensity on the pressing. Pedri just controls the game from the left alongside Busquets. So these two, like, they are two faces of the same coin, and they work perfectly for Spain. And today, in this morning, John Mueller has a piece on them. It's a great read. If we went to France, I really enjoyed their wing play combinations. So we've got Mbappe on the left, Dembele on the right. But the combinations are really good with on the left when Theo came on instead of Lucas, with Rabiot or Tchouameni dropping to cover. And also in the final third, there were many solutions. So if they put them in 1v1 situations, the dribbling is great. Also, France did lots of cutbacks. If they want to do crosses, Giroud's there. So many solutions in terms of final third when we go to the wing play. And also how we go to the wing play, we've seen the great distribution from Upamecano and Konati. Like, for example, the fourth goal. But throughout the game, their distribution was great.
It's interesting what you say about Spain as well. Michael, how much do you think that going into the tournament, obviously the quick turnaround from club football to international football, that having... thinking about Spain's midfield, Gavi, Pedri and Sergio Busquets, obviously three players who play their club football together at Barcelona. How much do you think that counts in terms of just that quick turnaround, being able to have such familiarity within your international side going into the tournament, rather than, you know, compare it with summer tournaments where you do have that ability to build a bit of cohesion as a team? Do you think that kind of counts for a little bit more here?
Yeah, I think that's probably a good point. And I think it's also worth pointing out, I mean, Spain, they've always looked, under Luis Enrique, they've always looked very cohesive. And I think in terms of shape and understanding and you know, what they do between the boxes, I think they're the best European side by quite a long way. I think we saw that at the Euros last year. I think it's a good argument they're actually the best team at the Euros. I mean, they lost to Italy on penalties, but I thought we're dominant in that semi-final. So yeah, I think it's a good point about this tournament. I think it is a factor. And I think some of the games we've seen, first round, I mean, they haven't all been bad, but some of them almost feel like a pre-tournament friendly. You know, the teams just haven't had that game to kind of get in the groove. And yeah, Spain obviously very much an exception to that.
That neatly brings me on to my next sort of part of this podcast, of from the formality results into more of the early surprises so far, shall we say. I want to talk about comebacks and World Cup shocks. And I guess my question before I get into it is that, do you think because of that quick turnaround that there's more likely to be shocks in the first round of fixtures because they feel a bit more like preseason friendlies, as you say, there's not enough opportunity to build cohesion. So if ever there was a time for an underdog to gain advantage, then even within the tournament, the first round of fixtures would be it because there's such little training time to get to that first game.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Again, that's a good point. It's such a unique tournament in terms of the lack of preparation. And we have seen a few of the big sides, I think, just not hitting the ground running. I mean, even France, I know they ended up winning, but I thought they started really poorly first 20 or 30 minutes. I suppose the funny thing is that in the cases of both Argentina and Germany, they were 1-0 up at half time. And it's unusual. You have shocks of this magnitude, but it's even more unusual to see a comeback shock. I mean, usually it's a kind of park the bus job and maybe pinch a goal on the break or a counter-attack. But, you know, these sides had to rally. They had to find a plan B and they had to push forward and actually dominate the game. And I thought Japan in particular did that really well.
Oh, yeah, we're certainly going to come to that. I'm just going to go back to Group B before we do, because, Achmed, you wrote about this, the Wales and USA game, on the same theme of comebacks. It was a highly enjoyable match for different reasons. USA out the traps pretty well in the first half. Wales ended the game far stronger of the two, I think it's fair to say. Michael, I know you've had this same theme of a game of two halves, to use the cliche, but Achmed, would you say that this really was that?
It's not exactly a shock, but it's a comeback. In the first half, I thought USA's pressing was great. They pressed in the 4-3-3, a narrow one, with the white players on Wales' white centre-backs and Josh Sargent dropping on Ampadu. And behind that, we've got Weston McKennie and Musa on Ramsey and Harry Wilson. They did a great job of denying progression into the centre of the pitch for Wales. And even when Wales tried to reach their wing backs, whether Conor Roberts or Nico Williams, we saw Musa and McKennie moving out there with Adams covering for them in the center of the pitch. So yeah, all these denials of progression meant that Wayne Hennessy had to go long a couple of times. I think he went long 13 times in the first half. And one of those, USA won the second ball, and then on the transition, they got their first goal. In the second half, it totally changed because Rob Page brought on Kiefer Moore. They changed the approach. They were more direct into Kiefer Moore, who I think was the best player in the second half on the pitch. And actually, the penalty that Bale got came from a direct ball from Conor Roberts, but not to Moore, to Brennan Johnson, who came on when Rob Page moved to a more of a back four. So yeah, I thought it was a great game in terms of a game of two halves, and we've got a comeback. And actually, Johnson could have won it at the end when Roberts played a long ball into Moore, and then Moore held it up and backheeled it into Johnson's path, but he shot it straight at Matt Turner.
And in terms of Wales, do you think that is maybe how they're going to move forward in terms of Kiefer Moore having that presence, getting them up the field and... Yeah, some, the ball being able to stick, basically, because every time Wales got it, especially in that first half, they just could not get out, really. Do you think that's going to be a bit of a blueprint for them in the next couple of games?
Yeah, I think especially today in the game against Iran, like Moore definitely has to start. But against England, I think he'll go with the same forwards with Bale and DJ Daniel James. Maybe he starts Brennan Johnson as well.
DJ Daniel James, I love that. I've never actually referred to him as that before. Right, let's cover the shock wins. Saudi Arabia and Japan with 2-1 wins over Argentina and Germany, respectively. Maybe the results haven't actually necessarily been victories, but you could also probably include Canada and Belgium in terms of the way that both teams set up. In terms of what I want to know is, Achmed, do you think there was anything that was either similar or different in terms of the approach as the underdogs here for both Saudi Arabia and Japan?
I think it started the same based on a defensive organization. But in the second half, Saudi Arabia continued with the defensive organization and upped their pressing, which helped their high defensive line, which I thought was great throughout the game. But for Japan, it was attacking tactical switch between halftime. And I think Michael did a great piece on this.
Yes, I mean, I thought it was just brilliant. I mean, they got completely dominated down their right flank in the first half. With Raum just pushing forward to become a fifth attacker. It reminded me a lot of the way that Germany played against Portugal at the last Euros. And then Moriyasu made a, you know, absolutely transformative switch at the break, which involved taking off Kubo, who's an attack-minded winger, and bringing on Tomiyasu to become a fifth defender. And it just completely transformed the game. First of all, it denied Raum that freedom on the overlap and meant Japan had five at the back. But then it was almost like, you know, a complete tables were turned, because it meant that when Japan pushed forward, they were attacking with a front five against the German back four. And it was a surprise that Germany didn't do what Japan did and move to a back five. And then steadily, Moriyasu just brought on more and more attacking players. So initially, the wing backs were Sakai and Nagatomo, who were just converted fullbacks and not the most adventurous going forward. But by the end, they were attacking with a front five that was two really creative number 10s behind three wide forwards. And, you know, you can see for the first goal. And actually, they had a very good chance just before the first goal. And both those situations really came just because Japan were getting five men into the box. And, you know, eventually the ball landed for one of them. So, I mean, it was... I don't think we'll see another game in this tournament where there's just such a transformative formation change. It just completely flipped the game on its head.
And I think, as you say, that bravery from Japan to actually go and take the game back to Germany, I think is kind of key there. And Ahmed, that's what I want to ask you, I guess. It feels like the underdogs, shall we call them, who have done well against the so-called bigger sides, are the ones who have been braver out of possession as well as in possession in terms of their defensive organisation and sort of attacking build-up phase. Obviously, as Michael said, with Japan, with Canada, which, as we mentioned before, were really brave against Belgium, even though they did lose. You contrast that with Costa Rica, who were just so passive. Is it fair to say that the underdogs who have done well is because they've been far braver at moments? You know, sometimes we're talking about just a half here, but in moments have been really brave in their approach play.
Yeah, I think it's the theme throughout the first round that the underdogs, when they were good out of possession in terms of pressing or off-ball organization, they had a great game or half. So, as you said, Canada, I thought they were the better side. And as Michael said earlier in the pod, they were unlucky to lose. Their pressing totally dominated Belgium. Belgium couldn't reach any of their midfielders, whether Witsel, De Bruyne or Tielemans, or even Hazard when he's dropped because Alistair Johnston was man-marking him. We've also got Senegal, who, despite losing, I thought had a great game off the ball in terms of denying the Netherlands progression through the midfield, through Frankie de Jong or Berghuis. And Tunisia in the first half, I thought, totally limited Denmark. I think Denmark were only dangerous from set pieces, from corners. But other than that, like, Tunisia won every ball in the midfield. Issa Laidouni just won 3 million balls in the midfield. We've got Morocco as well. They didn't give Croatia's midfield a sniff. So neither Brozovic, Kovacic or Modric had any time on the ball. And we saw that Modric had to drop into a right back position just to escape the pressure. And actually, it's something that, as Zlatko Dalic said, that it's not good for Croatia when Modric drops this deep. But we saw that he had to drop deep because of the marking from Morocco. All of this shows us that there was a pattern in the first rounds in terms of mid-blocks and off-ball organization for the underdog teams. So this helped them a lot.
Fascinating stuff. I think the pair of you, when I hear you talk about tactics, you just see things on a pitch that I just can't see, especially in real time. So it's always good to hear your insight. I think on the note of Japan, I must say I have to give a shout out to Ali Maxwell, our host, who has gone out of his way to remind us that he did call it with Japan.
I read Liam's preview and I just felt something. I can't explain it, I can't describe it. I felt something, and I think Japan will spring a surprise here. I think certainly avoiding defeat against one or both of Germany and Spain. And I actually think I think Germany or Spain might be one of the teams, and there's always one, that crashes out but I can't choose who. Am I crazy?
You did call it, mate, so props to you there. Before we move on, obviously Japan, such is the nature of tournament football that you don't have much opportunity to accrue many points, so now only two games left for each team. Michael, I'll start with you. Do you think that there's a danger of Argentina and Germany not actually progressing through this group now, or do you think there's still time for them to claw it back with the quality that they have?
I'd still fancy Argentina to get through. I don't think they played particularly badly, and I think those remaining fixtures, they should get enough points from. I mean, Germany, that's looking perilous. I mean, the way that Spain played, that's their next game. If they lose that, it's curtains, which I think would be a shock. You know, there's some teams in this tournament who I wouldn't have been surprised had they gone out in the first round, even though they're amongst the favourites. I mean, France have a reputation sometimes for completely blowing up. But Germany, under Flick, good manager, good squad, I thought, you know, a pretty gentle first game. I think that would be a huge shock. But, yeah, it's the World Cup. We always have a couple. And, it looks like Germany are in the firing line.
Yeah, I agree with Michael on Argentina. I saw the Mexico-Poland game and I fancy Argentina to win both games, actually. In terms of Spain and Germany, I think Germany will get out. It's a prediction because I think Spain are a way better side, and with Japan probably beating Costa Rica, it will be 6 points Japan, 6 points Spain, and then Germany with 3 points if they beat Costa Rica. So yeah, I think Germany are in the worst, like from the big sides, Germany are in the worst position right now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
So in the final part, I want to discuss some general patterns that we've noticed so far across all the games. Some tactical, some not. And feel free for you guys to chip in with your own as well. We'll go fairly quick fire here, but we sort of spoke about it before, I think, that it's been a note on this podcast in the past that international football perhaps being a little bit behind club football in terms of style, whether that's talking about pressing, the use of fullbacks, things like that. But Michael, is there anyone aside from Spain that we spoke about before that you might have picked out as someone who plays most like a club side? Granted, it is just one game so far, but is there any, are there any patterns of play or anything that you've seen to suggest that?
No, I'm not sure there are really. I mean, there's a few sides I've been impressed by in terms of their cohesion with and without the ball. I thought England were very good in terms of some of their rotations in the wide areas. I actually thought Canada were really impressive, you know, considering the, you know, they've got a couple of decent players. But, I mean, they were so much better than Belgium, really. I mean, I thought it was, of all the games so far this season, this competition, that's the best example of one playing like a team and one playing like individuals. I thought they were really impressive, Canada, and I was quite frustrated by the end that they didn't get anything out of that game. But no, I think some of the better teams are still warming up. Maybe Portugal, actually. I thought in the first half, Portugal, their pressing was surprisingly intense. And, you know, for a side who, again, have often looked like a collection of individuals rather than a cohesive unit, I thought that first half, more than the second half, when they actually scored three times, there were reasons to be positive about them.
Yeah, like Michael, I think England were really good in possession. Not only the rotations, I think Mount overloaded the right side a bit coming from the left side. Bellingham's run from midfield, we saw that on the goal. Also Maguire's distribution, we saw that on the Bellingham goal as well. So I think in possession, England were really good in this 4-3-3 shape. And also Canada. I was really impressed with Canada in terms of their pressing. It was amazing to watch. And also in the possession game, we saw the left wing back, Alphonso Davies, and the right wing back going actually inside, but they weren't found that much. And on the ball, there were many runners. So whether it's Buchanan, whether it's Junior Hoylett, and the right center back, Alistair Johnston, actually overloaded a bit. So yeah, really impressed with Canada, and it's one of the games I'm looking forward to the next round, their game against Croatia.
To use another cliche, it felt a little bit like Canada did just kind of run out of steam in the end. And on that note, Michael, you being out there, so much talk about the air-conditioned stadiums and things like that. I know that it was a later kickoff with the Canada game, but have you kind of noticed anything to suggest that fatigue is going to be heightened by the temperatures out there?
I don't know. I think the answer to this is surprisingly complex, because the air conditioning usually is coming out from the stands and we're sitting in the stands and it's often quite chilly. But I think even when it's air conditioned, if you're playing in the sun, if you're playing in direct sun, so that's, you know, obviously the two earlier games, I think that's still going to be quite draining. So certainly the Cameroon-Switzerland game I was at, I thought that was played at a real kind of classic international tournament early game pace. I think the difference between the early games and the late games probably is quite significant. But obviously these days, five substitutes, you know, managers are, you know, I think they've got a lot of license to change things early. Obviously got to factor tactical factors into that as well. But I think almost the key so far, the best thing is not necessarily winning by a big margin, but winning games early. You know, if you go 2-0, 3-0 up within the first half, as England did, Spain did, Ecuador did, if you can just rest legs, you know, by not really playing at full capacity in the second half, I think that's going to have a massive benefit when it comes to the game, what, 4 or 5 days later.
And speaking of scorelines, we've had 4 0-0 draws already: Denmark, Tunisia, Mexico, Poland, Morocco, Croatia, and Uruguay, South Korea. I'm trying to think now whether or not those kickoff times might have been a factor in that. I don't know. But 4 draws in the group stage already is just 2 off the highest amount during a tournament first group stage, and there's still 32 games left. Is there anything noteworthy, or is it just a quirk of the tournament?
Yeah, as we spoke about the defensive organizations, I think most of the teams in the tournament, especially the ones that didn't score, and some of the African teams, they need to improve their game in possession. So they may be off the ball, their mid block is great, they are denying the opponents, but we've seen a couple of African teams who definitely need to improve their possession game if they want to move forward. So we've got Senegal, they didn't have many options other than playing it to Sarr. Morocco dependent heavily on the wing plays, but it didn't work out really well. Tunisia, the first half were actually good with playing balls in behind the Denmark defense, but in the second half, they just faded. Cameroon as well, when Switzerland went ahead and dropped deep, they couldn't break them at all. And the game was a bit slow, as Michael said. I think the anomaly is Ghana, but I think Portugal dropped a bit in terms of the defensive organization and the pressing after 60 minutes. So yeah, I think throughout the tournament, and not only the African teams, the possession game, the attacking game for most of the sides, with the exception of the big teams, it needs to be improved.
I mean, yeah, we talk about fatigue as well before. We're now playing nearly 2 hours worth of football. Michael, the topic of additional time, we've already seen more than 90 minutes worth of football in stoppage time alone so far. We know that this is something that FIFA have spoken about in advance of the tournament. Where do you stand on the introduction of more stoppage time, upwards of 100 minutes on average? Do you think this is something that you'd like to see more of when we return to club football as well?
Kind of. I mean, I don't have a particularly strong view on that in general. I think people have complained a lot in recent times about time wasting and that kind of thing. And my slight concern is that if we do move towards this, or even a kind of ball in play clock, which some people favour, that actually there becomes license to break up the game. And people say, well, you know, it doesn't matter about time wasting and going down injured because you're going to get that time back. For me, the most important thing is not the total amount of time played. It's just having a kind of constant rhythm. And I think games with stoppages in tend to just become quite bitty and scrappy. And the other point I'd make, just being in the grounds, is that, you know, as anyone who kind of regularly attends football will know, usually if you're in the ground, they display how much stoppage time there will be, but they don't actually run the clock. So the clock just stops on 90 minutes. So you have quite a funny situation. I mean, in that England game when there was about 15 minutes of stoppage time in the first half, you know, the players and the fans don't know how much of that 15 minutes has been played. So it's kind of another way, in addition to the VAR thing, where, you know, the people in the stadium do end up a little bit in the dark.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Michael about the rhythm of the game. And we had a hit at that a couple of years ago with the five substitutions. So I understand the five substitutions in terms of fatigue, players playing 60 to 70 games a season for the big sides, and they need to rest. And this helps them. But I think the five substitution breaks down the rhythm a bit. And adding to that, like 10, 8 minutes at added time, I think the game just dies. I would be interested to see the number of goals scored in those added minutes or the XG of those chances in these added minutes at the end of the tournament, and if there were any, actually.
I think as much as anything, it's just throwing the per 90-minute stats completely out of the window from a data perspective, which I think is just selfish. Us data nerds need to get a nice clean number here, and they are completely ruining it for us. Now, let's throw it forward. The fun never stops. So many games to still look forward to. We're going to be straight into the second round of fixtures starting today. Michael, I'll start with you. Which game across the second round of fixtures are you most looking forward to?
I think the best games are the late games in general. I think Argentina-Mexico, Spain versus Germany, and then Portugal versus Uruguay, obviously pitting the best two teams in each group together. You could probably extend that as well to England against USA tonight, which is obviously a very big game for The Athletic. Yeah, if I had to pick one, Spain-Germany, because it becomes, you know, from Germany's perspective, it becomes almost knockout football. It's the kind of game that could be a final. So yeah, if I had to pick one, I'd go for that. But Argentina-Mexico, actually a really similar situation. So yeah, I think the second round of games is going to be really good.
Yeah, like a couple. I think Michael mentioned them all, but I'm interested to see if Saudi Arabia can do it like in 1994 when they went to the round of 16. I'll be different and I'll choose Croatia-Canada. I was really impressed with Canada. And I think if they had the same performance like they did against Belgium, they can actually beat Croatia.
Canada very much the hipster team for everyone in this tournament, I think it's fair to say. So there we have it, our first entry in the World Cup notebook. Plenty more entries to come in the coming days and weeks. Michael, Ahmed, thank you so much for your time. For the latest and most comprehensive World Cup coverage around, including Michael and Ahmed's fantastic tactical breakdowns of some of the best group games throughout the tournament. Both of them hugely prolific at the moment. There's so much football going on, so much content being created on site. You can subscribe for just £1 per month for 12 months, our best offer of the year, by going to theathletic.com/tactics. I must also give a shout out to Liam Tharm and John Muller, friends of the pod too, working tirelessly to give you guys the best data and tactics insight out there. And of course, so many of our colleagues at The Athletic, leaving no stone unturned on every single football topic. That's all from us. We'll be back very soon. But in the meantime, thank you as ever for listening to The Athletic Football Tactics Podcast.
The Athletic.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.